Good evening. It's Saturday, May 9th with Sharon Sloboda. I'm David Rosenberg, and this is the KPFA Evening News. South Korean authorities today closed down more than 2,100 bars and other night spots in the capital city of Seoul because of a new cluster of coronavirus infections. Meanwhile, Germany scrambled to contain fresh outbreaks at slaughterhouses, underscoring the dangers authorities face as they try to reopen their economies. Germany and South Korea have both carried out extensive testing and contact tracing and have been praised for avoiding the mass deaths that have overwhelmed other countries. But even there, authorities have struggled with finding the balance between saving lives and getting back to business as usual. In the U.S., authorities are likewise watching for a second wave more than 2 weeks after states began gradually reopening. Internal government emails obtained by the Associated Press show that directives to ignore advice from the nation's top disease control experts for reopening communities during the pandemic came from the highest levels of the White House. Worldwide, the virus is confirmed to have infected over 3.9 million people and killed more than 275,000.
Today, a caravan of cars circled San Quentin Prison to deliver the message, "No state execution by COVID-19. Richard Tan is an attorney with the Labor Action Committee to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal. He says that failure to protect the prison population from COVID-19 is a matter of life and death for prisoners and puts the general population at risk.
In California, we currently have about 400 confirmed cases, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's actually already a higher rate than the California population as a whole, and we haven't tested everyone.
There's 400 confirmed cases, and you think there'd be more if there was more widespread testing. What are you all asking for?
You know, our view is that trapping prisoners in cells where they're housed several to a cell or in communal areas where they don't have private access to disinfected sinks and showers and food facilities is equivalent to promising them a slow death by COVID-19. We're demanding the release of the most vulnerable segments of the prison population, including the sick, the immunocompromised, the elderly, and also prisoners who are close to release and being on parole. Now, the California Department of Corrections has announced that they're going to be releasing prisoners who are 60 days off from their release date. But, you know, that's really been a drop in the bucket. And to give you a sense of what that's meant, they've released 87 people from San Quentin. San Quentin's population is about 4,000. There are blocks at San Quentin that are 200% over capacity.
In terms of balancing public health and public safety, Tan says both things are possible.
Statistics show that the rate of recidivism for elderly prisoners, at least, is extremely low. And I would imagine that it's the same for prisoners who are sick. And I really do want to emphasize, it's not just a matter of what happens to the prisoners, because if there's an outbreak in the prisons, it will get out.
Tan says the prison system has a precedent with providing substandard healthcare access, even in non-pandemic times.
You know, we've been paying attention to health issues for prisoners for a long time, because the Labor Action Committee to Free Mumia was involved in the international campaign to save Mumia's life a few years ago when he had hepatitis C. Back then, hepatitis C was the big health issue among prisoners. And the Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania basically abandoned Mumia, literally, in his cell, and, you know, were just waiting for him to die. And we organized a demonstration over at Gilead Sciences in Foster City, and we picketed the headquarters for the better part of a day, which was instrumental in getting Mumia hepatitis C treatment eventually. And there's a connection to the current crisis, too, because Gilead, again, is involved with the coronavirus. The CEO of Gilead is involved in efforts to develop a vaccine. And when people ask him, you know, what price are you going to charge for this vaccine? You know, like, his essential response has been, well, you know, trust us, you know, we'll find a way to make it a reasonable price. The drug Harvoni for hepatitis C, they were charging $10,000 a pill. So, you know, all these contradictions and problems, are happening again, just at a much more intense level, right?
For those who weren't at today's caravan but want to participate in the call to release vulnerable and soon-to-be eligible prisoners ahead of schedule for the sake of public health, Tan says they can help by urging Governor Newsom to take action.
The buck really stops right now with Gavin Newsom. The governor has the power to order the Department of Corrections to release more prisoners, and he has the power to alter the regulations governing the Department of Corrections so long as the state of emergency is going on. So write to the governor and demand that he take action to release more prisoners.
That's Richard Tan with the Labor Action Committee to free Mumia Abu-Jamal.
It's well known that relations are not good between the world's two largest economies, the U.S. and China, and many observers would say that things are getting worse. Joseph Gerson is with the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security. We asked him about the state of U.S.-China relations.
Perilous. It's a mess. It's disastrous. It's not good for either the United States or for China at this stage. I mean, what you have is structurally what's referred to in political science and historical terms as the Thucydides trap, the inevitable tensions between a rising and declining power. So we came into the pandemic crisis with this already at play. And with, I say principally, with Trump's efforts to divert attention from his failures and somewhat desperate to find a way to win re-election, he's seized on China as the source of the problem. Well, it was in some ways the source, but not in terms of the levels of disaster we've had here in the United States. And so he's been deepening the crisis. And while we have the obvious problems of mutual vilification over who is responsible for the spread of the virus and what its origins were, you also have accelerated military confrontations and buildup going on in the Asia-Pacific region between the United States and China with any number of flashpoints that could escalate into a really nasty situation.
And could you talk about some of those flashpoints?
Sure. Well, I mean, most immediately is the conflict tensions over control of the South China Sea. This is not an area that most Americans have been paying attention to, but I think something like 40% of the world's trade goes across those waters, among other things, providing much of the oil and fuel energy supplies for East Asian economies, not only for China, but Japan, South Korea as well. The Chinese, seeing the major source of threat militarily coming from the sea, and ultimately at this point coming from the United States, they've been focused on trying to build a barrier against interventions from the sea, and have claimed 80% of the South China Sea, which is in competition with a number of other countries that also have claims there. In many ways, you can see it as parallel to the U.S. Control of the Caribbean, the southern and naval access to the country in the United States. Long history there with Cuba, Puerto Rico, Monroe Doctrine, and the rest. And the Chinese are doing something similar. The United States, being the traditional power for the last 75 years in that region, has been resisting Chinese expansion into the sea. And so we've been sending what we call freedom of navigation vessels and fleets to challenge the Chinese. And here during the pandemic, you've had basically confrontation off the waters of Malaysia. So that's one.
Other sources of tension include the dispute over the status of Taiwan, which China considers a part of its historical territory, the situation in Hong Kong, where pro-democracy protests have erupted against the Beijing-controlled local authorities, and contentious trade issues.
The coronavirus pandemic is a trying enough time, as many are dealing with layoffs, isolation, and the threat of contraction of a virus without a cure. Adding on a cancer diagnosis at this time amplifies the uncertainty. Julie Casted is a furloughed dental hygienist who learned the week that Wisconsin's shelter-in-place directive was issued that her mom had inoperable pancreatic cancer.
She was diagnosed early March, and we got confirmation that at that time it was inoperable because of the location in the pancreas, but she could try chemotherapy. So she did choose to try chemotherapy, but due to the COVID-19 pandemic, her chemotherapy did not start until April 7th.
So what was that time period like, between the period between the diagnosis and the start of treatment?
Just a lot of questions of, are we doing the right thing? Is this okay to do? Are we waiting too long? Is it anything going to help? Should she even be doing it? Because now we're being pushed out almost a month from diagnosis.
Casted cares for her mother in rural Wisconsin and gets her to her chemo treatments.
She'll go one day, 1 week, and then one day the next week, and then it's another week off. So now before starting each cycle, at this point, she will have to be COVID tested no more than 96 hours prior to her treatment.
Casta drives her mother to a testing site an hour away. Without stepping foot outside of a car, a nurse conducts her mother's test.
She had her rest her head back, and the nurse measured from her ear to her nose. So she put the thing back in her nose to the back of her throat almost, and she counted till five. And then she took it out, and then we were able to drive through. So it was probably 25 minutes we waited from beginning to end.
And it's imperative that she stays negative because I suppose otherwise her treatment would be impacted?
Correct. They probably wouldn't do treatment if she was positive for COVID.
Casted says she's taking nothing for granted this Mother's Day.
Just the diagnosis of her having pancreatic cancer and just realizing how life is so valuable and it changes day by day, that we are able to celebrate this year with her. And she's not in the hospital where we couldn't be with her.
How do you find silver lining, or how are you coping with all these heavy things right now?
The nurse from the oncology department called my mom on Wednesday and let her know that her treatment is working. So that's something we can be thankful for this week. And even though Mother's Day will be more low key, we can still enjoy each other. I guess there's always chance for miracles, and that's what we hope and pray for.
As for those whose lives have been altered by the pandemic, who yearn to be with loved ones who may be suffering, Casted says, rather than focusing on what you can't do, do what you can.
Continue to do your social distancing. Call them on the phone. Get outside if you can. Take time for yourself and just relax and not let our world problems overtake you or overwhelm you.
That's Julie Casted, a furloughed dental hygienist and caregiver, speaking to us from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin.
When Barack Obama was president, he proposed a total refurbishment of the U.S. nuclear arsenal, and it appears that President Donald Trump wants to do even more. Anti-nuclear activists are not happy about that. Greg Mello was with the Los Alamos Study Group. We asked him what his group was most concerned about.
We are most concerned about these very plans and the lack of deep scrutiny of them and willingness to stand up to them. They're really setting the security of the U.S. at risk. They're a very obsolete set of plans, but Congress somehow is not stepping up to the plate. They're vulnerable, the plans, because they're way too expensive and they have a lot of managerial problems. And right now we are borrowing trillions of dollars to deal with a real national security crisis. So the money really isn't there.
You're particularly concerned about the plutonium aspect of the issue. Could you talk about that?
I certainly could. In order to provide a new warhead for the Air Force's proposed new missile system and its new warhead for the new missile system, new plutonium pits are needed. The United States has not manufactured these in any quantity since the close of the Rocky Flats plant for production. It closed in 1989. It stayed open another couple of years trying to get it reopened, but never did. So the United States doesn't have a factory for the cores of nuclear weapons. And this isn't a big problem because they age so very, very slowly. But if you're going to make a new kind of nuclear weapon and you don't have the exact kind of pits that you need sitting on the shelf, well, then you have to make new ones. So there's a crash program to open up another Rocky Flats plant, more or less, at Los Alamos National Laboratory, which is a remote site. It's on narrow mesas. It's a research facility. And they would like to get this production going in the 2020s to support deployment of this new warhead starting in the 2030s. Then, meanwhile, in parallel, a larger facility would be remodeled in South Carolina and set up as a larger factory. And from the neocon perspective, they're somewhat happy about this because they can play off the two sites politically against each other. And the Los Alamos site, which has problems, a lot of problems, either it will be disposable, so it will be a big rush and billions of dollars, and then the country would kind of walk away from that, or, which is more likely, they will double down on it, build a brand new big plutonium facility, and have two.
Mello says that many congressional representatives see spending on nuclear weapons programs in much the same way as they view other types of pork barrel allocations.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who has won bipartisan praise for his handling of the coronavirus crisis, is coming under increasing criticism for the situation in the state's nursing homes. Some observers have noted that Cuomo has often seemed dismissive and resigned to defeat when asked about the state leading the nation in nursing home deaths. Residents, relatives, healthcare watchdogs, and lawmakers from both parties cite problems with testing and transparency that they say may have prevented officials and the public from fully understanding the magnitude of the problem.
And you are listening to the evening news on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, K248BR in Santa Cruz, and KPFA.org with Sharon Sobota. I'm David Rosenberg.
Muslims around the world are about halfway through Ramadan, a time of fasting from dawn till dusk when folks traditionally break fast in community. 8-year-old Omar Mishak says it's not quite the same this year.
Ramadan goes on for 30 days and usually we'd go to the mosque and we'd spend a lot of time there.
So usually you fast all day and then at the end you go and break fast with the community and then you get to spend a lot of time with people.
Yeah.
And so how is it this year as you're just breaking fast with your family, not with the whole community?
It's fun, but it's not as fun. I think it's been more fun at the mosque because, like, we get to do it with friends and family members.
Eid this year is scheduled to begin on May 23rd.
The last day of Ramadan is Eid, and God says that, like, we're not allowed to fast on Eid because it's called Eid al-Iftar. It's all about not fasting, basically.
And it's usually done with a big celebration with lots of people. And so this year it'll probably just be you and your parents and your siblings.
Yeah.
That's 8-year-old Omar Mishak reflecting on Ramadan in pandemic times.
Food workers are among the most vulnerable workers when it comes to being affected by the coronavirus. Arun Gupta is an investigative reporter who has covered the plight of those workers. He recently wrote a piece for The Nation magazine about the massive number of immigrants in refugee camps along the U.S.-Mexican border, a situation, he says, that's very much related to what food workers are facing in this country.
Because the breakdown we see in the supply chains, it's happening especially in those parts of the industry that are heavily dependent on immigrant labor, such as meat processing plants, farm workers, you know, frozen food factories, all these dairy farms, all these have, use a lot of immigrant labor and often a lot of undocumented immigrant labor.
And so what's happening there? Are the workers not able to come to work, or when they do come to work, they're not really safe there? What's going on?
Well, so the meat processing plants have gotten, I think, the most attention, and in many ways, rightfully so. There's something like 500,000 workers in the U.S., and there are three sites that have become the primary outbreaks of COVID-19. Nursing homes, prisons, and these meat processing plants. And these meat processing plants, you can have like thousands, you know, like 2,000-3,000 workers. They're working shoulder to shoulder. They're cutting up animals, you know, in these horrific speed-up conditions. This is a low-wage, dangerous work. They're much more likely to get injured than workers on any other job. And U.S. meat processing, especially the industrial meat processing, is really quite a horror show in many ways.
Do they have protective clothing?
Well, this is the whole thing. It doesn't have to be this way. If you compare what's going on in the U.S. with what's going on in Europe, you do not see these outbreaks in meat processing plants in Europe. So the reporting that's coming out, what we're seeing is these big companies are allegedly, and we're talking about Cargill, JBS, Tyson, Smithfield, that, you know, there's basically this monopoly control of the meatpacking industry. They're telling workers to come to work work. They're not providing them with PPE. They're telling them not to spread rumors, not to talk about the coronavirus. So they're trying to suppress information. They're forcing workers essentially to work while they're sick. You know, sometimes they'll do it. They create like economic carrots and more often sticks. So like if you take off work, you'll get punished in terms of like, you know, if you have any sort of a pension plan or bonus coming, can get, you know, docked pay. And so it's a way to force the workers to come to work. And there have been numerous accounts in media like, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, Bloomberg News, about workers who were going to work while they were sick, working shoulder to shoulder.
That's investigative reporter Arun Gupta.
The coronavirus outbreak has shown a spotlight on wildlife markets that are common in many Asian and African countries. A so-called wet market in Wuhan, China, is alleged to be the origin of the corona pandemic, and many animal rights groups and activists are calling for a complete ban on the sale of exotic animals for meat. Activists say the trade and exploitation of wildlife should be everyone's responsibility. KPFA's Lola Akamu reports.
Since the outbreak of the coronavirus, there has been mounting pressure and outcry from various groups, including politicians, scientists, and advocacy groups, to ban wet markets worldwide that sell wildlife for human consumption. China has since issued a temporary ban on its markets, where animals like pangolins, bats, or wolf pups are crammed in small cages and in unsanitary conditions. Animals are bought and slaughtered on the spot, increasing the likelihood of the spread of diseases and viruses. Elizabeth Maruma Imrema, the UN Acting Executive Secretary for the UN Convention on Biodiversity, has called for a global ban on wildlife markets. Using the example of the Ebola outbreak in West Central Africa and the Nipah virus in East Asia, she said there was a clear link between the destruction of nature and new human illnesses. Brett Hartle is the Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. He says pandemics will continue to happen if attitudes towards wildlife don't change.
The species that are being exploited in other countries, those countries have some of the responsibility as well. It's not just one country's issue. Every country in the world is part of this trade. The United States is one of the largest players in the global trade of wildlife. We import something on the order of 200 plus million live individuals every year of wildlife from different species, and another 800 or so million specimens, so dead things. So I think when we think about where this came from, that this pandemic, it came from people. It came from people's bad decisions about wildlife. So I think what we would like to see is solutions not only in China, but solutions dealing with our own trade in the United States and every country's activities.
Hartle says the trade of wildlife should not be acceptable and that there should be better policies to address the problem.
But, you know, this global pandemic, the coronavirus, no one knows for sure where this came from. We have a very high likelihood that it came from nature, from most likely a bat species of some type. But that actually means that it came from our sort of society, our global culture, our approach to wildlife in general, which is one of which where we sort of assume that it's the prerogative of people, that we have an inherent right to simply exploit wildlife as we see fit and do with it what we see fit. And that this is how many pandemics start, including this one, SARS, MERS, Ebola. All of them come from our sort of callous disregard for the natural world and for wildlife, with this notion that we can simply do with it what we like.
Again, that was Brett Hartle, the Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. I'm Lola Komu, reporting for KPFA News.
Forest defenders on the North Coast have raised another tree sit in an active harvest area in an attempt to put a stop to clear cutting. KPFA spoke with the tree sitters, Walter and Lupin.
We've now been occupying the trees here on this hillside for 37 days. We're on land within the ancestral Surai village near so-called Trinidad. And Green Diamond Resource Company owns this land, and they would like to clear cut this area. So that's why we're here to get in the way of that.
How close is this tree sit to the other one I heard about a few weeks ago?
We can see the other tree sit from here. So it's like they're tied together. It's probably 70 feet away.
So do you see this as a major victory that you were able to set up another tree sit in the midst of this logging operation?
I think the big victory is that they've stopped logging, and the continued expansion of our project is, yes, we think it's successful, but it's also to accommodate more supporters.
Yeah, we made a second tree sit so that we could invite comrades to come and be able to have multiple people in the canopy who are safely social distancing while we're here in opposition.
So I take it you're getting all the supplies you need from people down below, the same kind of operation you've had in the past?
Yep. Ground support team.
Yeah, we're grateful to have that.
Do you run into any loggers or any timber company officials, or do they mostly stay away?
We've been here for 37 days now, and today some people from the company came, and it was the first time since the second day that we were here that we've seen anybody. They said that they weren't going to send any workers out a month ago when we started, so we were surprised to see the two men who came through today.
Do they try to get you to come down from the tree?
It was two security personnel from Green Diamond, and I was in the tree at the time, and one of them spoke to me and told me that they were just there to make sure that we were being safe. But subsequently, they started kind of harassing one of the folks who was on the ground as ground support. They tried to grab that person, they touched their stuff, and they were teasing them. So it seemed bizarre that they were supposedly there to make sure we were being safe.
How about local law enforcement officials? Have they shown up at all?
Nope.
My understanding is that Green Diamond does not wish to call law enforcement on us during COVID. That's what they have said. So I hope that that remains true.
Walter and Lupin and others involved with Redwood Forest Defense would like to see a complete halt to clear cutting in Humboldt County.
Vice President and presidential candidate Joe Biden has said unequivocally that he did not sexually assault his former Senate staffer, Tara Reid. This week, Tara Reid responded in a YouTube interview with former Fox and NBC host Megyn Kelly. KPFA's Ann Garrison has more.
Speaking to Megyn Kelly this week, Tara Reid said that she is willing to testify under oath that Biden sexually assaulted her in 1993 and undergo cross-examination. She also said that if Joe Biden is willing to take a polygraph test, she will too.
If I can just go back for 1 second to Blasey Ford.
Yes.
Some of those who supported her, but now have found a reason not to support you, say, well, she was under oath. Would you go under oath?
Absolutely.
They say, well, she subjected herself to cross-examination. Would you do that?
Absolutely.
They also point out that she took a polygraph controlled by someone on her team. Is that something you want to do?
I'm not a criminal. Joe Biden should take the polygraph. What kind of precedent does that set for survivors of violence? Does that mean we're presumed guilty and we all have to take polygraphs? So I will take one if Joe Biden takes one, but I'm not a criminal.
Biden has not offered to take a polygraph test, but those who were at the top of his staff in 1993 and for most of his career have said that they do not remember any complaints filed by Reid and that they would remember if she had indeed filed them. Biden nevertheless refuses to approve investigative access to records of his years as a Delaware senator from 1973 to 2009. Last week, MSNBC host Mika Brzezinski pressed Biden on why he will not approve access to these records now held at the University of Delaware.
Your Senate documents at the University of Delaware were supposed to go public, and then they were resealed. The access was changed. I know that you're saying any HR complaints could be in the National Archives, but why not reveal your Senate documents that are being held in Delaware? I know there's 1,800 plus boxes, but if she believes and she alleges that the complaints may be hidden there, why not strive for complete transparency? Why was the access to those documents sealed up when they were supposed to be revealed?
Well, they weren't supposed to be revealed. I gave them the university. The university said it's going to take them time to go through all the boxes. They said it wouldn't be, and that wouldn't be before 2020 that occurred, or 2021. I can't remember the year they said.
Tara Reid told Megyn Kelly that Biden's refusal to allow a search of his Senate records is, quote, telling, unquote. In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
And the weather for the Bay Area, lows in the 50s tonight, partly cloudy on Sunday, highs in the 80s, lows in the low 50s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, lows in the 60s tonight, highs in the 90s, lows in the high 50s. And that's it for the news tonight. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Ann Garrison and Lola Conmo for helping to prepare tonight's news. Carla West is at the controls with Sharon Sobota. I'm David Rosenberg. Good evening.